I'm going to read from Echoes of Silence. Okay. And I'm going to read from it a little bit about the book. It is written sort of like a love story. It's also a murder mystery. It's also a historical, it's about the history of a family. So it's written really to be enjoyed. But of course, there are hidden messages underneath the way the story is written. So for instance, the person who's telling the story is a Malaysian Chinese woman who has fallen in love with an Englishman whom she met in Germany. And it's not about me. For me, it was a way of trying to explore. See, I felt one of the reasons why we had so many problems in Malaysia between races, between the different ethnic groups, you know, is that it's all because of colonialism. Even the attitude of superiority that some people have towards others is the result of colonialism. So I thought then that the book would explore where in colonialism does it begin, you know? And from that point, I got this feeling that people like me, like my father's family, you know, being English educated and all that, we, and without roots to our Chineseness, we have no more roots, you know, we are lost. We are sort of like the children of colonialism. We are the orphans. We have no parents. We are actually orphans, you know. So this feeling of not belonging anywhere is here. But what I wanted to explore in this, so if we think of ourselves as children, then somewhere at the beginning there must have been a liaison between the colonial and the Asian, right? How did it happen, you know? So I told in this novel the love affairs, all the love affairs in the novel are between a Westerner and a native person, right? So the narrator is Malaysian Chinese, her lover is English. In the story, there is also a Chinese Malayized woman, and she has her lover is an Englishman. And then there is an English girl who's actually Eurasian. Her mother was a Eurasian. So the whole line of Eurasians, you know, and she grew up in England, so she's white, considered white, and her lover is a Malay man. So all the relationships in this book have to do not just inter-ethnic, but inter-cultural, inter-geographical almost, right? It's about, all the love stories are about the story of colonialism. Right. Well, let me just read this part where she is describing how Ailian, the narrator is a woman called Ailian, and the lover is an Englishman called Michael Templeton. So here she's describing the relationship when they first became lovers. We became lovers, Michael and I. Or perhaps I should say, I became Michael's lover, choosing the word carefully. Because in the simplest sense of the word, I was. I loved him. I loved him physically. Long after we became lovers, I often startled myself at the way a sudden, sharpened awareness of some trivial aspect of his body, such as the shape of his nose, the angle of his elbow, the suppleness of his fingers, could make me melt with desire. I loved him for his intellect, for his knowledge of so many things, for his experience, for his wit, for his accomplishments as a musician. I loved him for his hedonism, for his love of good food, for his appreciation of good wines, and yes, for his knowledge of my body. Until then, an undiscovered country to myself. I love him as clay must love its potter, because in a sense he made me. Seeing the desire in his eyes as he took pleasure in my body, seeing how much it pleased him to see me take pleasure in my own body, I assumed validity as a being. Not a complex or profound being, merely an elemental physical being, but through him, beautiful, desirable, precious, capable of indescribable joy. I was too innocent then to think in terms of giving and taking, of using and being used. All that was to come later. At that time, there was only the sublime sweetness of hungry surrender and generous desire. I want you. Please take me. So, in this description of her love for Michael, hidden in all this description is, of course, the question of the meeting between the colonial and the colonized, the colonizer and the colonized. At some point, according to Aileen, the way I saw it, writing this out, which became clear to me, is that at some point there is a worship of the colonizer. Now, then I will read to you a little bit where she discovers her grandmother, whom she had never known, right? She grew up as the only child of English-educated parents who had little time for her, and she never knew that she had grandparents. So here is she talking about the background. I was an only child. Although I was given to understand by my parents that I had a large circle of relatives on my father's side, I never had anything to do with any of them. On my mother's side, there was only an elderly spinster aunt who was so grim and had so little patience with children that I hardly ever saw her. Once, when he was in an unusually communicative mood, my father told me that my grandfather Lim, like many wealthy Chinese men in his day, had several wives and an unknown number of children. My father was the only son of the youngest wife. Soon after he was born, my grandfather died. My grandmother then returned to her parents with her father and lost touch with her Lim family. I should like to be able to say that my grandmother left the Lim household a rich woman, or that from some abject poverty, my father built himself a fabulous fortune. That is the stuff on which myths involving the overseas Chinese are made. But my father was not so obliging. He was a singularly dull man. He was a government servant. My mother, also educated in English, was a school teacher. While they were at work, I was left in the care of a long line of servants who came and went without making any impact on me. The only bright spot in my life as a child was the fact that we lived in one of a row of government quarters, and I had the neighbors' children to play with. Should I continue?
Yes, please.
My mother's being a teacher gave her some status in that small community, a status she was not reluctant to make the most of. I, a product of what was then the Malayan middle class, English-educated government servants, did better at school than many others who came from non-English-speaking homes. All that, and the knowledge that my grandfather had been rich, gave me a feeling of superiority. Except for that one time when my father told me about Grandfather Lim, he had not spoken of his family. And since I had never met his mother, I assumed she was dead. When I was 7, however, my mother had to go for an operation. It was, It was timed to coincide with my school holidays so that I could be sent away, presumably because the combination of her convalescence and my presence would have been too great a strain on the servants. I was then told that I would be spending the holidays with my pawpaw. Pawpaw is grandma, yeah? My father took me there to my grandmother. It was so far from where we lived that he had to hire a private taxi. After almost a day of traveling, we came to a stop along a small road. There was no house in sight, and all I could see was a rough bridge made from planks and coconut trunks thrown across a large ditch. But my father asked me to get out and started to take my bag out of the car, out of the boot. He had to carry me across the bridge because nothing would induce me to walk on it. We came to a group of wooden shacks, which I know now to have been squatter huts, built by someone who did not own the land, but saw an opportunity here for a lucrative enterprise. He had built the poor homes out of wood and attap. It's the kind of roofing made from the leaves of palms. And the poor homes out of wood and attap and rented them out cheaply, I hope, to those who were too busy scraping together a daily subsistence to see the same opportunities their dubious landlord did. My grandmother took me to visit them once during my stay with her, and I discovered that the little community, exclusively Chinese and all vaguely related to one another, consisted of a trishaw peddler, a lorry driver, two lorry attendants, and a couple who mixed bottles of colored powder in large tubs of water to be rebottled and sold to ice water hawkers in the nearby village. I liked the house best. It was fragrant with the sharp essences of chemical orange, lime, sarsaparilla, and rose. But on that day, my father and I walked right past them. We came to the beginning of a footpath leading into what I thought was a forest, but was in fact an abandoned rubber small holding. It was a world filled with movements and sounds. The tree branches above and the undergrowth below rustled and sighed. Birds sang, insects chirruped, crows cawed, unseen animals called, and occasionally ripe rubber seeds burst in sudden explosive cracks. A town-bred child, I had never been near so much vegetation, earth, mud, and streams before. All I knew about forests were based on the English children's stories I had read. As the undergrowth became thicker, visions of wolves and bears came to my mind. I began to worry about witches and children being abandoned by their hard-pressed parents. The question worrying me all morning had to be asked, "Papa, who's Popo?" "She's your grandmother." "Grandmother? I have a grandmother. Why haven't I met her before?" "Because she lives too far away, as you can see." "Is she your mother or Mama's mother?" "She's my mother." "Why didn't you tell me about her?" "What's there to tell? She's your grandmother, that's all." "What about Mama's mother? Is she alive too?" I was beginning to get my first inkling of how secretive, even deceptive, my parents had been. "Your mama's mother is dead, you know that." "I did not, because no one had told me." "Papa, I don't think I want to stay with Popo." "It's too late," said my father. "She's expecting you, and besides, here we are." I saw ahead of us a little wooden hut with an attap roof. Next to it was a large shed, similarly roofed. In front of the shed stood a thin old woman in black trousers and a blue Chinese blouse. "Ama," said my father when we approached. "Papa," I addressed her in greeting as I had been taught, my voice caught in my throat. "Frightened of me, are you?" she said in Cantonese, and stretched out a skinny, wrinkled, large-veined, brown-spotted hand to stroke my head. I shrank back and clung to my father. "You see," she said in a mildly reproachful manner to my father, You never bring her to see me. No wonder she's afraid of me. No need to be afraid, turning to me. Let me show you something. I understood her only because I had learned a smattering of Cantonese from the servants. In fact, because the only Cantonese I had ever heard was spoken by servants, and because my grandmother was dressed like one, I thought she was a servant. It was difficult to connect what I thought of as a lowly station with someone who was a member of my family. I think I began to reject her from that moment.
Well, on that note, Chua Guat Eng, thank you so much for being a part of the Listen by Heart podcast. It's really been an honor to speak with you, to understand what goes on that creative mind of yours. I really, really look forward to meeting you in person.
Well, thank you for inviting me to take part in this. I hope that you go on to do lots more interesting interviews with lots of people. We have quite a number of women writers.
You have been listening to Jasmine Lowe's Audio Journey Experience, an AFT podcast production. So you can subscribe to the podcast on your preferred platform, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, and so on, Google Podcasts. And if you like, encourage us on this project, you can click onto our website, listenbyheart.webprojects.com. The Listen by Heart podcast is an audio project that sets out to record and archive stories from women of the South China Sea, an area of much interest lately. As we document and record all of these stories, we will also be digitizing and creating an online presence for women of Southeast Asian heritage and honoring the women and men who came before them. Our mission is to serve as sentinels of the South China Sea, keeping our region at peace. Thank you for listening. See you next time.